Now I'd like to take a second to introduce both of our guest speakers. First joining us is Ken Anderson. He is the Director of Environmental Business at Aon Environmental, and he's based in Chicago, Illinois. His expertise is in designing, negotiating, and implementing complex environmental risk management programs for clients throughout the U.S. and the world, and he has over 15 years of experience with these negotiations. Also joining us is Arthur Harrington, who is co-chair of the Environmental and Energy Law Practice at Godfrey & Kahn in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He has more than 25 years of experience working on environmental issues and extensive experience in litigation and mediation. He has provided lead responsibility for many major environmental land use disputes and transactions involving contaminated property. So at this point, if you would click the slide 2, this will show you all the topics we will be covering in today's seminar. First, we'll start with a discussion of some other risk management approaches to brownfields cleanup and redevelopment. We'll then move into talking about what I think everyone here today is here to learn about, environmental insurance products for brownfields redevelopment. Next, we'll spend a little bit of time talking about negotiating these policies and claims experiences. And finally, we'll hear about a very interesting example about how environmental insurance and some other risk management tools were used to move a property toward cleanup and redevelopment. So with that, I'm going to turn over the first part of our presentation today to Art Harrington.
Thank you, Ellen. I will be spending about 10 minutes with you all in this next section. I'll be covering slides 3 through 7. And what I am going to do in the next 10 minutes is talk a little bit about a 40,000-foot view of approaches on brownfield redevelopment issues, talk a little bit about the players involved, what motivates them, as well as a very general overview of some of the risk management techniques that certainly come to bear in deals like this. And I know that we've got a great group of participants here on the line with lots of experience, and I really want to talk about this from a very conceptual level to really sort of lay some of the groundwork for the later discussion this afternoon, the time with you. The slide number 4 talks about the players, and I think it's really important to key in on the players, because to make these deals work, for all of you who are involved in these deals on the phone, you know how important it is to figure out a consensual approach to making these developments successful. To the extent that these developments go into litigation, it is a deeper hole that gets darker as time goes on if these can't be a consensual approach. And they're complicated deals because of the parties involved. Everybody is motivated by a different set of goals. And if you just think about the obvious with the sellers and the buyers, briefly speaking, the seller wants to offload any liability that they have on the site for the maximum price and walk away from the site and never see it again. And, of course, the buyer is motivated by just the opposite parameters of a deal. They want to get the property for the least possible price and avoid every possible liability. And, you know, those goals, obviously, on first blush, are at a complete odds with one another. And it gets more complicated as you think about the other parties that are involved in almost every one of these deals. To the extent you're talking about existing development, where there are current tenants on the property, or even a proposed development where there are going to be tenants, I would say, generally speaking, the tenants are motivated by the same set of goals that a buyer has. They don't want liability for pre-existing contamination. They want to be protected, and that's their set of the stakes in the outcome. And I think on a lot of these sites, you have to think about potentially responsible parties who may have caused the contamination, and those are likely, in many instances, going to be somebody maybe even other than the sellers. And how they are going to be dealt with on a deal like this is extremely important. And, of course, when we talk about developers, we're usually talking about future parties coming onto a site, especially if you're talking about some manufacturing sites where they're going to be flipped to commercial or residential use. You've got to think strategically about the risk avoidance goals of the developers that are going to come on the site in the future, because these deals are not going to work unless you provide for them in some capacity. And, of course, the lenders and investors, as we all know, start out of the box as being risk-averse. They're in the business of providing money for these deals. They're not in the contamination liability business, so you've got to figure out a strategy, if you're a part of the team here, how to insulate the lenders and investors from pre-existing contamination. If you go to the other part of the slide, let's talk about the regulatory agencies. They're motivated generally, as we all know, by public policy to clean up sites generally. They're not generally in the redevelopment business, although I'm sure everybody's experience on this is that the agencies are becoming much more friendly than they have been in the last 10, 15 years to redevelopment issues. But let's face it, their public policy goal is to protect human health and the environment, and they're going to be motivated primarily on a site by those goals, and you have to accommodate those legitimate concerns. The other points here, if we talk about the municipal entities, the land use regulatory agencies, local officials, economic development officials, in my view on these deals, they are the motivators for getting these deals done, and they're primarily motivated by two matters in my experience, is to get the site, to facilitate the site redevelopment, and of course to protect public access, public assets by making sure those municipal entities, to the extent they are involved in a deal, do not inherit environmental liability on a redevelopment site. And finally, we come to, I think, one of the very key players that we're going to talk about at greater length here is the insurance companies. Insurance companies see this as an opportunity because of all the concerns I just mentioned on the other parties. There is a need for certainty and avoidance of risk, and with some of the new policies that are coming out, the insurance companies have stepped up to the plate in a way to facilitate these deals by offloading liability by contract. And I think I speak from the matter of some recent deals that I think this is a great development in terms of trying to facilitate all these varied interests on a deal like this. Let's go to slide five. And, we're going to talk about the traditional risk management tools, some of which have been helpful, some of which have been difficult to deal with. I will say this, that all of these techniques need to come to bear in almost every deal. Where, traditionally, the due diligence has been an important part of a transaction where you want to conduct as much inquiry as you can about the property. That becomes a challenge, as we will talk about later, in terms of how much information you want to develop, how long it takes, how does that drive the economics of the deal. It's really a matter of judgment in terms of how much is enough. And as you will find out from Ken Anderson later on, it's a critical element of the risk underwriting in terms of how that risk management tool comes to play and what kind of detail is needed. Obviously, contractual party contractual protections are incredibly important on the buy-sell agreement. Traditional contractual provisions include indemnification agreements, representations and warranties, covenants. I mean, these are lawyers' dreams in terms of what lawyers like to do. They love the draft agreements. And, of course, the buy-sell agreement is a critical document for managing the risk and transferring risk on deals like this. We are talking about contaminated properties and a buy-sell agreement that's going to be used for redevelopment. The buy-sell agreement is obviously a critical element of the deal. Financial tools and how you deal with future unknowns, even if you can't determine all the existing environmental issues. There's obviously escrow accounts that can be set up. There's future purchase price adjustments. Grants and loans can help mitigate the risk through the EPA brownfield programs, the state grant programs. Lots of new tools on the horizon and that exist now that help mitigate the risk in the form of financial tools. And, of course, we're going to be talking a lot about the next point here, environmental insurance. And last but not least is the statutory protections that are provided under federal and state laws. I'm sure everybody's experience is a little bit varied here, but as a general rule, when we're dealing with brownfield redevelopments, 90% of the action is at the state level in terms of regulatory agencies dealing with cleanups. So you want to be very, very familiar with the statutory frameworks for liability exemptions that exist under state law. And, of course, you don't want to dismiss the fact that we're in a federal system of government that has a overlay by our federal system, which can't be preempted by state law. And so you have to factor in EPA's interest and the federal government's interest on the site. But again, in my experience, I think, 90% of the interest that will surface on a site will be state motivated. And that's why it's critical to be familiar with the state exemptions that exist, many of which apply to some brownfield transactions. And let's just turn now to the next slide, which is slide six. Talk a little bit, this slide in a very conceptual approach talks about some of the benefits and costs of each of these management techniques that we talked about for limiting risk. And I think these are obvious if you look at it, the due diligence. I think the biggest negative on a thorough due diligence is the amount of time it takes. And the fact that time is money on a real estate development, and to the extent that people want to get perfect transparency on a property transaction, you are going to kill the deal in terms of the time elements that are required to find everything you need to know about the transaction. And so that's one of the negatives, I think, on due diligence. You know, escrow agreements are very helpful, except you got to figure out a mechanism to know what the estimate is going to be for the cost so you adequately fund the escrow for an unknown event. And that creates a lot of uncertainty, a lot of deal problems in terms of the buy-sell agreement because of the uncertainty about the number many times that has to be escrowed to deal with uncertainties. And, again, that all ties in, I think, with the applicability in certain instances of insurance vehicles as a way to mitigate that risk. We talked about indemnities, representations, and covenants. Those are important on the asset buy-sell agreement on these deals, but those representations and warranties are only good as anybody knows on this call the creditworthiness of who's standing behind them on the buy-sell agreement. That creates a lot of hand-wringing amongst the professionals on the deal, in particular the attorneys, trying to get behind the creditworthiness of who's providing an indemnity. It is a very, very difficult issue and uncertainty unless you're dealing with some of the largest companies that are going to be around. Lots of these indemnities are written with unlimited time limits, and so you have to kind of make projections about how long parties are going to be around. And again, I think this plays into some of the benefits of an insurance vehicle as a additional security device. You have to consider statutory common law recourse. These are very, very difficult issues. It's judge-made law, and that law changes as we speak. It is very difficult to predict how common law provisions are going to be interpreted over time, especially when you are dealing with real estate where people may be holding title for 10, 15 years. It is difficult to make predictions about what rights are going to exist against the parties who are on the deal. These are difficult issues. The statutory safe harbors we talked about are these exemptions that are provided under state and federal law. They are complex and they are varied as there are states in the union. These are state-specific exemptions, and if you are doing business in more than one state, it creates complications because you have to be knowledgeable on the particular state overlays. Even if you have a federal system with a uniform federal law that applies in the form of the federal Superfund law, the hazardous waste laws, again, the action is in the states on the cleanup on these properties, and every state has their own unique statutory provisions, which I think complicates these deals in a way that creates more professional obligations for due diligence. The last thing we talk about here is the management tool of no further action letters, comfort letters. You go by various names, but it's the agency's attempt to give the innocent buyer some comfort before they step into title that there's no known problems on the site. And the problem with no further action letters for the risk-averse buyer is they are filled with reopener provisions, as you could imagine, with a state or federal agency providing an assurance letter. To the extent there is something unknown about the site, public policy dictates that there has to be a reopener. And while comfort letters are valuable for purposes of a buy-sell deal for the buyer's perspective, there are lots of gaps. And again, the existence of comfort letters actually provides some benefit, as we will hear later from Ken Anderson on the insurance underwriting, but again, all these factors show the need that not one of them, standing alone, is going to do is going to be able to get the deal done. You've got to look at a combination of issues to accomplish those goals. Now, I wanted to move the slide, I guess at this point, I will say what is probably obvious, that every deal is unique. We're on slide 7. There's no environmental panacea. Each tool has a shortcoming, and I think this is a great side, is the goal of both the buyer, the seller, the lender, the developer, the state agencies, the local agencies, everybody on the deal is to really to avoid a liability trap. And, I think this seminar hopefully will talk about some of the methods to do that. And I think one of the methods we're going to talk about now a little bit is insurance. And Ellen, I don't know if I should turn it back to you or turn it to Kim.
Well, since you're sitting in the same room, you can. You almost just did that. Next, we're going to turn to Ken Anderson, and he's going to share with us a little bit about environmental insurance and the products that are currently on the market today to help move, like Art just said, move contaminated property towards reuse. Ken?
Thanks, Ellen. And to build off of Art's closing point in his last slide, and that is when we transition now and talking about environmental insurance, the key focus that we as practitioners in this area have to remember is that it is only a component of the overall deal. And so with that, moving on to slide number 9, I want to talk a little bit about how insurance has evolved or in one instance kind of dissolved when it addresses environmental risk. Slide 9 speaks to the what's happened under general liability and excess casualty liability insurance in the United States, and this is generally speaking. Prior to 1972, when organizations bought their liability insurance, there were no pollution exclusions on those policies. So because they were occurrence-based, in other words, when the event occurred that caused the loss, many organizations have gone back to those policies that were enforced prior to 1972 and asked the insurers to pay for those losses. Classic example would be a Superfund site where disposal happened in 1960 or whatever. In 1972, the insurance industry looked at this issue, especially with the advent of EPA coming on in 1970, and said, you know, we understand the issue of something sudden happening, so we will pay for the sudden and accidental pollution event, but we're not going to pay for the gradual event. So we're not going to pay for the things that happen over time. The problem with that language of sudden and accidental, it was not defined within those policy forms. So from 72 to about 85, you have some ambiguity under casualty insurance programs that suggests we don't know whether or not the policies pay for it. And each state, by the way, has its own interpretation. And there's a whole industry of lawyers and insurance experts who are trying to figure those answers out, and they've been answered in most states. Since 1986, when organizations, again, buying their casualty insurance program, the insurance industry came out with language that we colloquially call the absolute pollution exclusion. It's not called that in the policy, but if you read exclusion F on any general casualty policy, primary or excess, that's what we refer to usually as the pollution exclusion. And if you read that, it says it doesn't matter if it's sudden, accidental. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even use those words. It says if it's an escape of a soot, irritant, blah, 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 that causes a loss, it's not covered. That's generally what we call the absolute, in our industry, the absolute pollution exclusion. So the point of this slide is that since 1986, for 20 years, unless an organization has actively looked to buy environmental liability insurance on their casualty insurance programs, they've been uninsured or woefully underinsured. Going on to slide 10, I want to talk about the environmental insurance industry. If you look at the insurance industry in the United States for environmental insurance, now I'm switching gears. And what I mean by when I say environmental insurance, these are policies that are in place that in the insuring agreement say we pay for loss caused by pollution events after emanating from locations or whatever it is. So these are actively covering pollution losses. Technically, they've been around since 1980 on a continuing basis. With respect to brownfields, they've really only been functional within the last 10 years or so. And this slide 10 kind of points to that time frame. If you were to look at, say, pre-1995, early 90s, late 80s, the environmental insurance industry was really starting to understand the bigger picture of pollution events. They were understanding them when you got to landfills or treatment stores and disposal facilities, but they really didn't understand that risk from just general, manufacturing or municipalities or whatever other insurers might be of interest. There was also little competition amongst the insurers. In the early 90s, there were only three practicing large environmental insurers in the United States, and even though they were large insurance companies, they didn't write a lot of premium because it was generally looked at as restrictive coverage. It paid for a lot of times the losses related to financial responsibility under the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. So it was specifically like corrective action issues and things like that. So the language was really regulatory driven. Low limits were available. High premiums because there wasn't much competition, and it often looking at very extensive engineering costs in the early 90s or before and you weren't necessarily guaranteed coverage even if you paid the engineering fees. All of that changed in the 90s. What we saw in the 90s and what we see continuing today in the year 2006 is that we have a lot of competition amongst carriers. And so there's a number of carriers offering this. And even though there are a number of carriers and there's also a great deal of underwriting expertise when it comes to environmental risk, there's still a lot of subjectivity, especially on a brownfield deal. What one insurer may think is a risk of concern, another may not. So you do get subjectivity, but that's okay because there may be five or six or seven insurers willing to look at any one risk. The coverage can be absolutely tailored to meet the specific needs. Even though each insurance company has its own policies that are quote-unquote off the shelf, for each brownfield deal, we'll do a dozen, two dozen, or more endorsements to modify the coverage to meet all the parties' needs that Art mentioned earlier, and that is, what are all the risk issues that each one of them are facing and how much can we transfer to insurance? Generally speaking, the premiums are cost-effective. Multi-year policy terms are available, so even though they are claims made and reported policies, you can still take care of a multi-year window. Deductibles are very reasonable. Minimum deductibles may begin in the $10,000 to $25,000 per loss range, et cetera. So that's kind of where we are, where we were early days and where we were today and where we have been really for the last 10 years or so. Slide number 11 speaks to today's marketplace. The major environmental insurers in the U.S., and it's about a $2 billion industry in the U.S., are AIG, Zurich, Chubb, ACE, Liberty International, and you can remove Quanta from the slide. This slide is a little bit dated, so you can delete that. But of those top six insurers, you've all got A-rated insurance carriers or better providing coverage. You have a lot of environmental underwriting expertise, which means you better learn their language or know their language when you're speaking to them. I mentioned that the premium in 2005 for the total industry was about $2 billion. Of that, our professional estimates, probably 35% are related to property transactions, brownfield transactions, et cetera. So you've got a healthy industry of hundreds of millions of dollars of premiums being transacted for property transactions or brownfield development. You can look at $50 million or more, so the availability of limits are there, or if you needed to stack insurers to get more than that. And it's absolutely competitive when it comes to pricing. Moving on to slide 12, specifically for brownfields, I've already mentioned that we tailor the coverage for each project. When I get involved and when people ask me, well, you know, what can we do in the insurance marketplace, the first discussion I want to have is more of the kind of a business and what are the issues at hand. Let's not talk insurance yet, but let me understand the deal, the development process, the risks at hand, who's asking me the question, is it the developer, the seller, the municipality, the bank? I mean, so I want to understand that. Generally speaking, you can look at the policy, you can look at the insureds on a policy, and you can make a number of different entities the insured. Sometimes we bring everybody into the insurance policy, or as many as we can. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes the buyer might just want to use it as a backstop and might not want the seller to know that they're using it. So there's a lot of different, and vice versa. So there's a lot of different ways to insure groups, and the insurance companies are willing to listen to those arguments and to understand and negotiate those issues. Generally speaking, when you look at environmental insurance, the industry, you can break them down for brownfields into four components: pollution liability insurance, cost cap insurance, lender pollution liability, and finite or blended risk. So I want to spend a couple of minutes on each one of those risks. Slide 13 talks about pollution liability. Here I'm talking about liability insurance that applies to the site itself. In the marketplace, we call these pollution legal liability insurance, environmental impairment liability. Each environmental insurer has its own name. Generally speaking, you're paying for the cleanup of unknown, pre-existing, and or new conditions at or emanating from the site, and you're also paying for the third-party claims that could arise from those pollution conditions at or emanating from the site. That's generally the basic coverage form. Some insurers differ, but just for argument's sake, let's just talk to that level. You can look at then the insurance to deal with other risks related to the site as well. And one of the biggest risks on brownfield redevelopments is the business interruption and or construction delay cost. If there's a delay related to pollution loss, the tenants aren't going to get in to pay rent in time and or the contractors are going to expend extra monies to get the deal done. And so those coverages are available. Pollution-related claims at non-owned disposal sites. We're going to maybe be generating waste that needs to be disposed somewhere, so you can cover that non-owned disposal site issue. pollution-related claims related to the transportation of that waste and or product if it's an ongoing entity. Natural resource damages, how do we cover those issues into the policy? I put this more as now an additional coverage because more insurers now are looking at this as something they want to discuss, whereas 2 or 3 years ago it was something that wasn't even discussed. It was just thrown in. It was part of the initial deal. Diminution of property values often is also something that insurers want to have a separate discussion on. But generally speaking, any of those, and there are many more bullet points that can be negotiated, but those are some of the big categories of additional coverages. I mentioned it's claims made and reported. That's okay because what we wind up doing is not only a multi-year term more often than not, upwards of 5, 7, 10 years, but we also look at no retroactive dates. In other words, we're insuring all the pre-existing events at the site that we don't know about. The premium levels, they vary widely. So do we do pollution policies under $50,000? Absolutely. Do we do them over $100,000? Absolutely. But if you needed to strike me down, a lot of them are in the $50,000 to $100,000 range. Minimum deductibles or minimum premiums are 5 to 10, but a lot of them are $50,000 to $100,000 for the policy term paid once. Usually they're a 5-year policy or 3 to 5-year policy term, maybe 7. The limits, generally speaking, we're asked for usually on a brownfield no less than $5 million and maybe up to 20, but you can absolutely get $1 million if that's all the risk at hand. And the deductibles, even though they do exist at $5,000 to $10,000, don't be surprised if on certain issues the insurer wants higher than $10,000, like $25,000 or more. The next category of cost cap insurance on slide 14, generally speaking here, is you're worried about the losses that exceed the known costs of cleanup. So the basic coverage pays for the cost overruns related to the remediation expenses that are outlined in some sort of developed cleanup plan. And right now we're seeing those cleanup plans from the underwriter's side need to be reviewed and approved by some regulatory agency. So the underwriting has gotten much tighter in this area, generally speaking. That's not always the case, but that's usually what it is. It would also pay for the changes in the standards of the law. So if the regulations actually change during the course of cleanup and now you have to address a new issue or to clean up to a greater standard on the known issues, you can cover that as well as the contamination that you didn't know about. If you discover that during the course of cleanup, you can insure those issues as well under the basic policy coverages. As I mentioned, you typically need the remediation plans pretty well detailed as well as the action, the cost issues. We are looking at period policy terms, generally speaking, the length of the cleanup project. If you're within 5 years, that's not an issue. If you go between 5 and 10, it starts to look at, well, what are the real issues here at hand? The premium range, and again, this is a wide range, but generally speaking, you're going to pay 8 to 20% of the limit that you purchase. The limits that are available are sometimes capped at 2 to 3 times of the expected cleanup, and you have to have a cleanup that's significant. This doesn't work on a corner gas station at $75,000. But if you have a $1 million cleanup or more, then you can start talking about this insurance. And again, your limit that you're going to be able to purchase is probably going to be capped because the underwriters are thinking, why would you want to buy a $20 million cap on a cleanup of $1.1 million? What do you know that we don't? So that's generally that issue. There's going to be a layer as well. In other words, if they think the cleanup is $1 million, the insurance companies will not come in at $1 million and $1. Generally, they'll say, we want there to be an additional 10 to 30% above that before insurance comes in. And even after insurance comes in, a lot of times now we're seeing co-insurance apply. So think of it as health insurance. The insurance carrier doesn't want to pay every dollar after the buffer layer and SIR is expended. They want to pay 90 cents on the dollar, 80 cents on the dollar. Again, it's a way of risk management from their standpoint to make sure that the insured has an incentive to get things cleaned up timely as well. And the last bullet point is right on of an underwriting fee. It's not uncommon these days to see environmental insurers to say, even if you want us to look at this and offer you a quote, we have to hire the engineers or at least internalize those costs, and we want to charge you for that. And that underwriting fee may be in the neighborhood of $10,000. Moving on to slide 15 very quickly. The lenders also have an interest, not that they could necessarily have the legal obligation to clean anything up because they have federal and usually state protections for that, but the fact is that the loan goes upside down and they have to foreclose on it and take over this property, they have and it's contaminated, they have an impaired value in their collateral. So they may want to insure their risk. And so we've seen this marketplace change a little bit, but nonetheless, think of it in terms of a bank. You can insure the collateral value, the loan balance. Typically, it's the lesser of the loan balance or cleanup costs that will be paid to get the site back up and running. The underwriters, sometimes lenders are requiring this on a portfolio of loans, so they require the property owner to purchase it on their behalf. And so it's a variety of things, but you're only protecting the interest of the lender here, not the borrower. Generally speaking, the premiums and policy terms can be all over the board, but generally it's the limit is the amount of the loan, and the deductible is $25,000 and up on that. The final category of finite and blended risk on slide 16 speaks to a term of art that is still really well used and viewed in our industry. Finite risk has gotten a tough name last year in the insurance industry, generally because of what was or wasn't insurance on loss portfolio transfers between insurance companies. From the environmental insurance industry standpoint, they're very valuable coverages because what we do is, in addition to pre-funding, say, a known loss, the known cleanup, we actually buy one or all of the three coverages that I just mentioned, and that is we buy protection for cost overruns. We buy protection for third-party liabilities. We do this over a period of time. So this actually winds up being used a lot of times in transferring the total of the environmental risk issues over to the insurance carrier so that then the insurance carrier pays for the cleanup and also takes on the responsibility for the cost overruns as well as third-party liability. So that's the concept there. It is the terms, these are highly negotiated policies, and really it's a matter of, the individual needs of the deal. So slide 17 basically summarizes my points, and that is environmental insurance can absolutely, on the left side, reduce uncertainty. We can take care of things issued related to unknown contamination, third-party claims, et cetera. We can support the indemnities and hold harmlesses that are negotiated by counsel. That's what it's used very well for. It supports that due diligence process. It is not a replacement for it. And it can firm the sale price. I've seen it. I've seen it enhance sale price. Does it automatically do it? Absolutely not. So that's the bullet points on the right side. It does not eliminate all uncertainty. There are exclusions. There are going to be provisions in the policy. So there may be some uncertainties that still exist that we're going to have to deal with some other way using what Art had mentioned. Maybe that's the contract between the buyer and seller, whatever. It does not replace indemnities. It does not replace due diligence. So we get the phone calls every now and then of, hi, we don't have any due diligence information. Can we buy insurance on these sites that have been around for 100 years? The short answer is, yeah, you can buy the insurance, but the premium is going to be higher than the limit you buy. So what's the point? Art made the comment earlier in terms of due diligence. The way I liken it as, I always get the question, do you have to have environmental site assessments? The technical answer is no, but the clearer you can paint the picture, and the more recent that picture is painted, the better terms and conditions you're going to get the insurance marketplace and the better premium. So that's my comment on that. It does not automatically enhance the sale price, nor does it pay for conditions specifically excluded by the policy. You'd be surprised how many times we get asked to pay for an underground storage tank when all along we knew that those tanks were excluded in the policy or whatever the example may be. So now I'm going to turn it, I want to now talk a little bit in the next couple of slides, skipping through slide 18 to slide 19, talk about the negotiations of the coverage itself and what my experience is to understand. I've been on the insurance brokerage side for environmental issues for some 13 years. So this is what I see happen, and that is, first and foremost, the experience of the broker, the insurance broker, that is, the attorney and the environmental consultant, the more experienced and well-versed those three parties are in the transaction of environmental insurance, the smoother the process and the faster the process is going to be. What that means is that we can probably, on point number two, look at the critical environmental information. We don't need everything. We'll get the real critical documents to make sure we can paint the picture for the underwriters as clearly as possible out of the gate. For expediency, because Art's point is right on. Usually on brownfield transactions, it's being driven by some sort of a deal, whether that's a municipality need or a developer need or an opportunity, and so timing usually is very short in these. So that's the other point that we need there. If we understand then what those issues are in terms of the environmental information. The other key piece of information we want to provide the underwriters is what are the contractual arrangements and what are the regulators agreeing to, or where are they in step with this? And in brownfields, you get a wonderful experience in most, if not all, states now, and that is the regulators, even though the primary charge is the protection of human health and the environment, they also understand that, look, these sites aren't helping anybody right now, so why not have them put back in a safe way into productive use? And so that's, if we can understand that and get those into the underwriter, the position of the insured or insureds are going to be best presented. We can also look at, hey, look, if we need to speak to the regulators, can we speak to them? Sometimes that answer is no. I get that. But if on brownfields, it's usually yes. And so if that's the case, then let's engage them in the process. And I've done some seminars with Ellen and EPA throughout EPA regions saying, look, you may be getting, and also states, you may be getting more calls in this area. And also understand what the risks are. Why does the insured seek this coverage out of the gate? And clearly point that to the insurance carrier so you have a clear blueprint. Moving on to slide 20, you need to make sure that the policies are specifically negotiated for the deal itself, for that site. So, and we need to read them very carefully. And counsel is invaluable in this process where they start looking at it from the view of a pure contract, because that's what it is a contract between two parties. And so what are the terms? Is there clarity, et cetera? The broker should bring value in that process as well. So that's part of that issue. So read them carefully and make sure that you understand what you're getting into. And combine them and understand where they fit in this overall puzzle of creating certainty of risk. So understand where they fit, if there's an escrow, if there's an indemnity agreement, or whatever. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if you have the qualified people, both on the brokerage side, legal counsel, environmental consultant and advocate side, you're going to have a real good then process with respect to the insurance underwriting process. So now I'm going to turn it over to Art, and he's going to talk a little bit about some of the more finer points when you're talking about negotiating the actual policies themselves.
Thanks, Ken. And what we're going to be doing now is we're turning to slides 21 and 22, and what I want to do is go down from the general overview approach and sort of drill in to a couple of these insurance policies that Ken has been talking about. And in particular, I want to talk about the pollution legal liability policy and the cost cap policy. And if you don't take anything away from these two slides but one thing, I feel that I will be a success. And the one thing that I'd like you to take away from these two slides is the need to read the policies very carefully and negotiate. You cannot, in my judgment, whether you're representing a buyer or seller, anybody who's going to be a named insured, additional insured, rely and do a deal simply on the specimen policies that you're provided with, because every one of these deals is unique, and the specimen policy, in my experience, has to be negotiated. And the reason the factors I use to make that statement are some of the bullet points on slide 21, dealing with the pollution legal liability policy. There are certain standard provisions in this policy that need to be addressed depending upon your particular deal. For instance, the carrier, if you look at these policies, retains a subrogation right where it can step in the shoes of the insured and the payee, pay out on any type of claim, to step in their shoes on any rights they have on insurance policies. And if you are talking about a state that allows potentially recovery against some of the comprehensive general liability policies that Ken talked about earlier, you are going to have an interest on limiting the insurance companies under the environmental policies' right to seek rights against some of your insured policies, and that's the subrogation right, and you really need to look at that and potentially renegotiate that. There are also some very broad carrier's cancellation rights that have to be looked at in the standard terms and provisions, and in my experience need to be narrowed in some fashion, because they are quite broad on first blush on many of these specimen policies. The other thing that I think needs to be looked at very carefully is there is a prohibition of actions against the carrier, generally speaking, in some of these policies, unless the insured is in full compliance with the policy terms. And that is a provision that needs to be looked at, because there are numerous obligations of the insured, some of them which we would agree would be material and some of them not so material, and you need to take a look at those and heavily negotiate which non-compliance issues are going to cut out the ability to maintain coverage. It is very important to look at those provisions. Another very, very important provision is the next bullet point, which is the separation of obligations of additional and named insureds. As we will talk about a little bit when we get into the example, on brownfield deals, it is very typical that you are going to purchase a policy that is going to have, in addition to the named insured, many, many additional insureds, depending upon who gets on the site risk later on in terms of a future developer. What you want to make sure is if one insured does not comply with his or her obligations on the policy, that doesn't undercut the ability of another insured to get the benefit of the policy. And it is typical that you can renegotiate these on get a separation of insured's obligations, and it is very, very important to look at that on the policy on pollution legal liabilities. Other thing that you have to be very careful with, and Ken mentioned this earlier, is that these policies typically have a deductible obligation before you can reach into the dollar one coverage. Those deductible obligations on a pollution legal liability can run from $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 at a deductible. That critically is important on the premium. And you have to, if you're on a multi-party deal, it has to be very clear as to who is going to have that obligation to make the deductible payment to insure and afford the rest of the parties the insurance coverage, and that is to be heavily negotiated, and you need to give some thought to that. The last thing I'll mention is a very important issue as well, is generally speaking, these policies will have a pollution legal liability out of the box. There will be an exclusion for known pollution conditions. And in my experience, there is the ability with the underwriter to renegotiate those. If you have a known solvent plume, for instance, on a policy, on a piece of property, and you want to get a personal injury property damage protection for that, generally speaking, there's a known pollution condition exclusion, but those are subject to negotiation where you can actually negotiate some protection for personal injury property damage if the underwriter gets comfortable that the matter is being dealt with. There's actually an opportunity to negotiate that, a very critical element to a lot of deals where there's known environmental conditions. But let's just turn briefly to slide 22. That is our next slide. Now talking about the cost cap policies, and just again to review, what we're talking about here is the policy that insures the parties for cost overruns on a remediation. And I've listed some of the points in the specimen policy that need to be addressed on the slide. There's a number of them. Time doesn't permit to go into all of these, but I think if you take a look at things like the third to the last bullet, there has to be a very careful clarification of what the scope of the approved remediation plan is. This underwriting and this policy is driven by the underwriter signing off on an approved remediation plan, and it has to be very, very clearly drafted in terms of what the remediation plan is covering and what is being approved, because that is going to be the operative document for purposes of providing coverage for cost overruns. The parties involved have to be very, very careful about looking at that. I'll also mention, too, in the limited time we have here, the last bullet point, which is understanding the need to coordinate reopener coverage for such conditions under the pollution legal liability policy. Now, what I mean by that, it is a very important issue, is generally once you get a closure on an approved remediation plan, the cost cap policy, if it's done within the estimate, goes away. And if there is going to be a reopener 5 years from now after the original closure is given, generally speaking, the cost cap policy does not respond to that. You need the pollution legal liability policy to respond as a third-party claim in the future. And this is why the finite risk option that Ken referred to earlier is so important, because many times it is great to have a combination of both the cost cap policy and the pollution legal liability to deal with not only cost overruns, but a reopener by the government, as well as personal injury property damage claims. And hopefully the example will provide some meat on those bones. But at this point, Ken, I'll turn it over to you on the next slide.
Next, I want to talk about some of the aspects that go into selecting an insurer. The first one's kind of obvious. They better have a specialization in providing this coverage. Generally speaking, the ones that I mentioned before have, I mean, they do have specific underwriting departments in their groups. It's not to say you can't go in other insurance carriers and get some add-ons to coverages, but they're not applicable to what we're trying to transact in a brownfield redevelopment. But some of the more important issues that our clients have, especially in longer-term policies, are financial strengths and rating. And the broker can help provide this, or at least help point to some of the issues that come into play there. And so that's one of the key things. How long have they been in the insurance market for environmental risks is a key one. Related to that is, you know, what is the reputation for paying claims? Because these are basically contracts with a promise to pay if certain events occur. Well, what is their track record and why? And generally speaking, it's a very good track record in terms of paying claims, but understand that. And of course, when you select the insurers, a lot of times, first and foremost, it's more often the coverage that is available. In other words, what the insurer is willing to offer vis-a coverage almost always trumps price on brownfield deals. Because they're usually not, the pricing at the end of the day usually isn't so out of line that, you know, you don't. So it's usually the coverage trumps price. So those are some of the factors in selecting an insurer. When you look at the premiums, there's a lot of functions related to that. But here are some of them, and that is, first and foremost, the limit of liability that you want to purchase. That drives a premium. How much risk you're willing to assume. Depending on what the how big of a risk the underwriter thinks, that could have a big factor in the premium side. Where are we in the remediation process? Do we know nothing? Do we know something? Are we in the middle of the cleanup? Size of the site, the level of characterization, the due diligence aspects, these all factor into premiums. How much has the regulatory group been involved? Some state brownfield redevelopment groups are very active and involved. Some are not. Usually speaking, the ones that have better oversight and involvement generally have a better underwriting view because there seems to be more certainty there from the regulator or overview standpoint. The future use of the site. Are we taking a heavily contaminated industrial site and making a daycare out of it? That'll have a factor of premium regardless of how we get there. Especially on cost caps, you know, what are the expected costs and what's that underwriter's perceived view and the volatility of that? And I want to transition into looking at the insurance claim side of the house moving on to slide number 26. The next couple of slides are critical with respect to how we submit claims to the marketplace and how we, and the level of detail and all of that. One of the first steps, in addition of notifying the insurer, there's notifying the broker. Notifying that specialized broker that says, look, we have an issue here. Because he or she then will be able to look at, well, now let's look at the policy. What are your contractual obligations in terms of submitting the claim? Who do you do it? What are the logistics involved? And understand that there are very specific languages in insurance policy. Sometimes it's as soon as possible. Sometimes it's as soon as practical. Sometimes the insurance policy might say you have to do it within X amount of days. It all depends on what that insurance contract said in the negotiating of it. And also understand that, you know, the logistics. Who needs to be put on notice? Do you need to notify the insurer on a suspected issue, on the condition itself, or do you need to notify them only when the claim is actually made? You have to understand all of those aspects of it. Very critical, and that is keep accurate records, verbal as well as written. Understand, you know, phone conversations, document, all of those issues. Moving on to slide number 27 is more of the logistics of it. This is what happens during the claim. The insured submits the claim. The policy, even if it has multiple insureds, there's usually a first named insured, and that is the party that has the primary responsibility for submitting a claim. If you are additionally insured and or named insureds, you can provide that. If you're named insured, you can provide that notice as well to the insurer. The insurer then will send out an acknowledgement. They have to. Under most states, that acknowledgement has to come out within 60 days of saying, yep, we got the claim, thank you. Here's the claim number. It's not necessarily going to say we agree and here it is and here's a check. It may, but it's just going to say we have acknowledged it. We understand what policy, here's the person who's assigned to it, et cetera. The claims adjuster then gets involved in the claim and we'll send a second issue saying, look, letter saying, okay, we accept it. We understand the events. We've been in contact with everybody. Yes, it's covered, and here it is. And then the second letter usually says, look, this is the reason why we're taking this position, whether we accept the claim or we deny the claim. So that's the concept of submitting the claim. Now I want to turn it back to Art, and Art's going to walk through the application of insurance and some examples and some discussion points on that.
Great, and just before Art starts that, I wanted to put another reminder to the folks participating today that you do have the opportunity to submit questions to our speakers. We will be doing a question and answer session after we talk about Art's example. Please click on the question mark icon on your screen, and that's the way to submit a question, and we will get to them after this is a very exciting example out of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Ellen and Ken. What I'm going to do now, the remaining slides are 28 through 38, and what I'm going to do as part of my presentation, I'm actually going to key in on slide 29, and I'm going to keep 29 up for my presentation. A lot of what I'm going to say is covered by the balance of the slides, but I think there's some to aid really in the summary of the example, I'd recommend that you keep slide 29 up here for the next 10 minutes when I go through this example. And this is a particular example in Wisconsin. And what you're seeing on slide 29 is an aerial view of a site referred to as the American Brass Site. And this is I think by any stretch of the term of a brownfield site, a massive site. If you look at this picture, on the upper right-hand corner, that's an easterly direction. And the road that is on the east side of that plant is 14th Avenue. And if you look at the left-hand corner of the picture, that is the western edge of that site, and that is 20th Avenue. So this is a half-mile-long facility. And the upper left-hand site is a northerly direction, and that is 60th Street. And on the right-hand side, the south direction, it is 63rd Street, so it's a three-block-wide facility. This facility was in existence and operational for over 100 years. It is a brass foundry, and the history of this site is somewhat interesting to get the flavor for the dynamics of this deal. This site, as I mentioned, was in operation for over 100 years. It was sold to a company that many of you on this call are probably familiar with, the Atlantic Richfield Company, known by the acronym ARCO in the mid-70s. And ARCO sold that property to a management buyout group who in turn later on in the history of the site sold it to a company called Outokumpu. And Outokumpu ran this facility then until the year 2000 or 2001, at which time, since it was an old site and it had some younger sites around the country and the world, decided to close this site. And the proposed use for this site after plant shutdown was for warehousing. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the interest that the city had in this site. If you look around this site in almost all directions, what you see is a residential area. It was a relatively low-income residential area that the city had spent a fair amount of time trying to stabilize and really provide a boost in the form of infield housing, brand-new housing. They had substantially invested lots of city funds to stabilize this area because it was an area in transition. And the city, the last thing the city wanted was this to turn into long-term warehousing. It was absolutely inconsistent with the master plan for this area. And the city actually saw this as an opportunity with the plant shutdown and a change of use to try to get over, to get control over this property. Now, I mention this because we talked earlier about the importance of analyzing the state law in any deal you do in a brownfield transaction. And Wisconsin, as a matter of state law, and you can probably transfer what I'm about to tell you to lots of other states, it provides some great advantages to municipalities who want to try to get into title on property like this. And in Wisconsin, there are two very important exemptions under state law. that apply to sites like this. If the city were to take this property by condemnation, our Wisconsin law provides an exemption for liability for pre-existing contamination under a statute called the spill statute. If the city gets into site here through condemnation or through a voluntary transfer for blighted property, the city has an absolute, generally speaking, exemption for pre-existing contamination. The other thing the Wisconsin law provided for rather recently is a cost recovery statute that allows the municipality, once they get into title, it can redevelop the property for its intended future use, and any environmental costs incurred for the proposed redevelopment can be recovered from the immediate past owner. Now, this is a statute that is somewhat surprising in its breadth. It is a relatively new statute in Wisconsin. But what the city did is it used both of these statutes as a very important element to the beginning to negotiate trying to get control of this site. And generally what it did is it went out and hired an environmental consultant, and there was limited environmental information known about this site. If you look at the lower left-hand corner, the west end of this plant, about the western one-third, there were two known solvent contaminant plumes on the site that were the subject of remediation. There were records in the DNR's files, which is our state environmental agency's files. So there was a fair amount known about the one-third, the western one-third part of that site. But the eastern two-thirds of the site, the oldest part of the site, there was very little, if anything, known in the agency files about this site, other than there was some foundry sand in this site, et cetera. But what the city did is they went and hired a consultant and had them use the available data and come up with their best case estimate of what it would cost to remediate this site for residential housing with basements. And the consultant came back with a reasonable good faith estimate based upon available data of $23 million for environmental remediation costs. And what the city did armed with that information is it had a sit-down discussion with the current owner of the site and said, we, city, are interested in this site, and there is an easy way to do this, and there's a very difficult way to do it. The easy way to do it is see if we can make a voluntary transfer to see if we can get this under control by the city and we mitigate our risk for redevelopment through some type of a contribution. And barring that, we are prepared to take this site by condemnation, and we will reduce the cost by the environmental problems we encounter. And by the way, we have a cost recovery statute, and we have done an estimate of what it would cost if we redevelop this property into residential housing, and that cost estimate is $23 million. And by the way, here's a state statute that allows us to recover that against you if we don't have a voluntary agreement. Now, after a fair amount of hand-wringing, the current owner of the site had some discussions with the previous owner of the site. You recall the previous owner of the site was the Atlantic Richfield Company, and they were acquired in a stock deal by BP Amoco. And what happened was the dynamics of this deal occurred when BP Amoco, together with Outokumpu, realized that rather than an adversarial proceeding here, there was an opportunity to offload environmental risk on this site and to get out of this site if a deal could get done. And that was an important dynamics change in the negotiations. And what happened on this site is, as I mentioned it early, there was not a lot known about the environmental condition of this site. There was a fair amount known on the western one-third, but very little known on the eastern two-thirds of this site. And another very important factor that allowed this deal to get done was BP Amoco brought to the table a very well-regarded environmental remediation firm in the name of TRC. And TRC did some due diligence on this site and essentially agreed under a fixed fee contract to take all the demolition risk and the environmental risk and present this site to a negotiated standard, a commercial use standard, for a fixed price. And once there was a combination of parties interested in limiting their risk and getting out of the environmental risk on this site, combined with a fixed fee remediation contract, that allowed the parties to start talking about a pool of money to get a deal done here. And what was also very useful on the fixed fee contract that was proposed for demolition and remediation by TRC was the fact that they brought an existing relationship to the table with AIG in the form of a finite cost cap limited pollution legal liability policy that in addition to providing cost cap coverage, it securitized the contractual obligation of TRC to deliver this site for a fixed fee. And once the insurance policy was put on the table, each of the parties obviously had their own sets of attorneys and consultants, and there was a heavy period of negotiation that involved not only the contract with the fixed fee remediation contractor, not only the buy-sell agreement between the city, because the city, when all was said and done, was going to get entitled on this site, and there was going to be a conveyance between the current owner, Outokumpu, and the city, but there also was heavy negotiation with the underwriter for AIG because we needed a very specific policy that ensured not only TRC, not only the city as a subsequent owner, but also as the beneficiary of this policy, VP Amoco and Outokumpu, and current owners and developers of the site. So it was very, very important for the reasons we talked about earlier to renegotiate this policy, because this was a policy that obviously had been used by this fixed fee contractor on some other sites. They all were unique, and the parties needed, because of the unique aspects of this deal, to negotiate. And what really immensely helped the negotiation, given the size of this deal, was that AIG allowed direct access by the parties with the brokers involved to a vice president who flew out to BP Amoco's headquarters and actually brought the AIG policy on his laptop computer, and the parties were in a conference room for 8 hours, and we essentially negotiated the specific insurance policy for this site, with actually getting direct authority with the underwriter. The underwriter was there. He was the vice president of AIG, and we all the parties negotiated the policy they wanted in an all-day-long 8-hour session that really helped facilitate this deal. And so what the city agreed to do once there was a fixed fee for the cost, and what the parties agreed to do was to fund that fixed fee by contributions from the current owner of the site, the past owner of the site put a substantial amount of money into this fixed fee. The city on its share received brownfield grants from US EPA and the state of Wisconsin, and it left about a $2 million gap for covering the fixed fee amount, and the city made that up through tax incremental financing on this deal. And in consideration for that structure, essentially the city agreed to an indemnity agreement for Outokumpu and VP Amoco for walking away from this site for the pre-existing contamination, in consideration for receiving a significant portion of the funding of the deal on the fixed fee remediation contract. So really, the dynamics of the deal worked, in my judgment, in my experience, primarily because of the following factors. First of all, the parties were able to determine what each of the parties needed and how this could be a win-win. And I think the dynamics of this deal really changed when, after an initial kind of adversarial meeting between the city and the current owner and its predecessor realized that there was a way to take this liability off its balance sheet by putting some money into a pool. That was very, very critical. I would say the other very important element of this deal was getting a fixed fee contract that really fixed the fee on a relatively uncertain site for environmental matters. I mean, I think the fixed fee contractor here was willing to take some risk and obviously got compensated for it in the fee that they negotiated, but they were willing to offload some of that risk onto a fixed fee contract. And I think what made all the parties even more comfortable was the fact that that contractual obligation was securitized by, a very substantial financial entity in the form of AIG on a policy that was heavily negotiated, that provided a backstop for environmental liability if it were to exceed the contractual obligations of TRC. And the final thing that made this deal work was the city's willingness to give indemnities to, you know, to the parties in the form of the current owner and the previous owner in consideration for getting a very substantial payment up front to make this deal go forward. And I think if you were to look at this site today, it is completely leveled. It is being redeveloped for commercial purposes. I think that the dynamics of this deal worked because it was a combination of a lot of factors we talked about at the outset of this. The fact that the parties understand what's motivating them, how to get to their goals, the fact that there were contractual provisions that were part of the management risk techniques, the manner in which fixed fee remediation contracts offloaded liability risk by way of a contract, and the fact that insurance played a very, very important role on this site. And I will mention that the insurance agreement, which is not atypical, allows additional insurance to be added in the future on the policy, which really provides a way to market this site for purposes of future development because of the long history of industrial use, the ability of these contracts to benefit future third parties was a very, very critical important element of this deal from the city's perspective because at the time they had this deal done, they didn't have a developer for the site yet, so there was some risk on that, but there are some developers now, and I would say the insurance elements of this deal played a very important part for bringing these developers to the table, having the additional protection in the form of insurance and their lenders for this development deal. So I think at that point, Ellen, I probably would turn it back to you. I think that's the summary of the example, and I think we should be up to slide 38, I think.
Great, thanks very much. So you can read all about all the details for this project by going through the rest of the slides that Art didn't cover explicitly. What I did want to draw your attention to was on slide 41, you have a link to additional sources of information. If you click on that, you'll be directed to EPA's website where we have additional information about environmental insurance as well as reports which have been issued by Northern Kentucky University, a glossary of environmental insurance terms, and some other reports which will help fill in your background information on environmental insurance. We'd now like to move into a period of questions and answers, and I really thank folks for cooperating and submitting questions online. So I'm going to just go ahead and pose some of these for Art and Ken and grill our experts. So our first question is from Jean Warshaw out of New York, and her question is, are there insurance products that make sense for sites where the cleanup is expected to only be about $250,000, or are the transaction costs so high that they only make sense for larger remediation? So, goodness, that sounds like a small cleanup, that quarter gas station, Ken, that you mentioned. What is your opinion on this for the smaller cleanups?
There isn't a market for the cleanup cost cap on a one-off deal. What we're looking at in the macro picture on those deals is there a way to bundle sites like that so that the aggregate loss is such that, and there's a spread of risk, that such an insurance company would take it. So we're looking at it, is that a municipality that can aggregate them? Is it a developer? So that's the only way to take care of the cost cap component. However, that doesn't mean there isn't a third-party liability not only from past issues, but from future development and future use issues. So if there's that component of risk, which quite often is a bigger risk issue when you start talking to all of the experts, whether it's council or you talk to the environmental engineers, that's really where the real dollars could get of issues. So I hope that helps answer that question.
Great, thanks. Our next question is from Rob Lukos from Pennsylvania, and his question basically gets to the point of when is the best time to involve the insurance carrier in a cleanup and redevelopment project. His question is it before you begin to characterize the site or while you're doing the characterization or after the fact, and then you may have a problem, I guess, with the carrier not agreeing with the characterization that you've done. So I guess in either of your opinion, either Art or Ken, when's the best time to involve the insurance carrier?
Well, this is Art. I'll take a stab at it and then have Ken supplement my answer. I think the sooner the better, it seems to me, that you can get a carrier involved, especially if you are trying to get some property. It's the subject of a deal or negotiation I think the underwriting process takes a while, and to me, to the extent that you can get some input from the underwriters earlier on, what would be valuable information for them for doing the underlying underwriting risk, if you're looking at insurance as an important element of your risk avoidance toolbox, my experience has been the sooner you can get the insurance people to the table and get a good broker like Ken or others, you know, I think the better for a deal if you want insurance to be an important element of the deal.
I would concur with that. If I'm reading into the question a little bit too, the question is, well, what happens if we get to the end of our assessment and the insurance carrier, then we go to the insurer and they say, do something different. Is that a risk? Yeah. But generally speaking, because there's a lot of subjectivity in the insurance marketplace, you may find one insurer to say that almost unless the job that was done was so erroneous, you're going to find somebody to look at it and go, you know what, there's enough information here at the end of the process, and we're comfortable with that. So even if you come at the end of the process, we get a lot of calls on a Tuesday morning saying we're closing on Friday, you know, can we get insurance? Do we like those calls? Absolutely not. Do we respond to them? Of course. It's the nature of getting the deal to close sometimes. It doesn't help the process, though, because you're also then at the mercy of the marketplace.
In addition, Ken, I believe you did also mention earlier the fact that the more information you have about the site, the more due diligence you've conducted, the more clear you are on what the remediation plan is going to be, the likelihood of getting a better price insurance policy and having the carrier be a lot more comfortable with the risk.
Yeah, and there's always a balance there, because there's a balance not only in timing, there's also a balance in terms of just the overall process. You know, do we really need to know absolutely everything to save 5% on insurance coverage and or get one more endorsement? I mean, there's a certain balance. So if we're brought into the process earlier, we can be part of that quote-unquote team trying to understand all of those issues.
Great. Thanks a lot. Our next question is from Richard Robluski from Pennsylvania. His question is there insurance available for formerly used defense sites, FUDs, that are part of a brownfields project?
Federal facilities are an incredible, important area from my business standpoint. I mean, we do a lot of work in that area. So the short answer is absolutely. There's been a lot. If you can name some of the 5 or 10 more famous federal facility redevelopments that have been done over the past 5 years, you'd be surprised. I bet you 80 to 90% of them had some sort of environmental insurance for somebody, whether it was the LRA, the developer, whomever. So absolutely. And it's being done all the time. There's a lot of expertise, whether it's Department of Defense, Energy, GSA, obviously EPA. I mean, there's a lot of expertise in the different federal agencies about how the insurances have been used and should be used.
In fact, I can just add to that too, Ellen. I mean, one of the opportunities for federal facilities are the BRAC program in terms of offloading the excess military sites. Even though under many of those sites, the federal government has a contractual obligation to deliver a remediation on the site, the big issue is at what standard they're going to be remediated. And in my experience, if you have clients that are looking at potentially purchasing those federal facilities under the BRAC program, insurance can play a real good role as some additional protection for the buyer.
Great, thank you. Our next question is from Harris Rayo out of Elgin, Illinois, and his question is really about maybe giving some examples of types of claims that Art or Ken, you've seen under the pollution liability policies or the cost cap policies, and the circumstances under which these claims were paid. So I don't know how much claims experience you guys have had. At least you said before that very often you're at least hearing things are being paid. But do you have any examples you could talk about where claims have come up?
Yeah, more. I've probably been involved in 4 dozen or so, give or take a few claims over on the broker side over the last 13 years. And of those, usually where they come up is we miss, especially in brownfield type transactions or property transactions, is we miss something in the due diligence because we are not Swiss cheesing every site, or maybe we don't even do any sampling, we just do phase ones. You know, we miss something, and is that wrong? Well, no, it just happens. And so more often than not, it's a cleanup related to that. But every now and then, it is a third-party claim. It is the contamination is actually now discovered to have gone off-site and has impacted the neighbors. And so every now and then it's that, but usually it's discovering something that was missed in the due diligence process.
And I would say just from my perspective, Alan, answering that question, I probably have done 8 brownfield transactions in the last 5 years with insurance as a component. And there's a good news and bad news for this question. The good news is for this question, I've never had to deal on behalf of clients with any claims yet. And I think one of the things that's happening in this area from my perspective, especially with cost cap policies, is the environmental remediation firms that are offering the cost cap policies in consideration for fixed fee remediation contracts tend to be somewhat conservative on coming up with their cost estimates, because my understanding is if you go into these policies as a remediation contractor, you're going to have some difficulty with the underwriter writing the next one, and so there's some caution on the cost estimates they come up with for purposes of the cost cap policies. And for that reason, if you are looking at fixed fee contracts on deals like this, securitized by a cost cap policy, my recommendation is you want to go out for a request for proposal, if time permits, for more than one or two remediation firms so that you can get a reasonably best price with a comparable insurance policy. I mean, it's not directly called for by this question, but I think it's a strategy that should be considered when you are looking at fixed fee contracts with remediation contractors with an element of insurance. I think if time permits, it's good to go out for requests for proposals.
Great, thank you. All right, your discussion of the state of Wisconsin's new law seems to have sparked a bunch of interest in this law. So could you, we've got one question from Michael Grange out of Fort Worth, Texas. He'd like to know, can you give the name of the law or a place where they can find the language from the law?
Sure. It's the municipal exemption that I referred to under the Wisconsin law, as well as the cost recovery aspect of that law, is found in our Wisconsin chapter 292. I'm going from memory. I think the municipal exemption is in 292.11, and the cost recovery statute, I believe, is in 292.32 of our Wisconsin statutes.
And maybe what we'll do after this call is post a link to that, and folks can log when they log on to the website to see the other materials from the presentations today. We'll include linkages to those two statutes.
Okay.
And related to the cost recovery component, we have a question from Jerry Kuwal out of Tampa, Florida. He wants to know what cost recovery actions are available, assuming, is it for unrestricted land use? Are there any contingencies on what that land use is going to be when taking advantage of the cost recovery ability for municipalities?
Again, I want to emphasize, this is our art again, Ellen. I want to emphasize that this is a statute that is unique to Wisconsin. It is very, very important to look at each of the states that you practice in to see if it's a comparable provision. But the statute that I'm talking about that is unique to Wisconsin for cost recovery says on its face that you can get reimbursed, the municipality can get reimbursed for all of its environmental costs for its intended future use. It is very broad on its face, but the one thing I want to emphasize, it is a reimbursement statute. It does not allow you to recover monies from the immediate past owner before you incur the cost and spend them. It's a reimbursement statute. It is not a statute that you can get monies in advance for the use. But in terms of what types of environmental costs, it is not limited to the current use of the site. If the current use is industrial and the municipality would want to turn that into residential housing with much more environmental costs associated, this statute on its face allows you to recover those additional costs.
Thanks for clarifying that. I did want to remind folks that if we don't get to your question or if you think of other questions after we hang up today, please see the front page of our seminar. It has email addresses for Ken, Art, and myself. So again, that's if you click on the little symbol that looks like a house, that will take you back to the main seminar page, and then you can see everyone's email addresses and feel free to contact us afterwards. Our next question is from Peter Chirazio. I'm so sorry if I'm butchering your name. From Glattenbury, Connecticut. His question concerns institutional controls and the availability of environmental insurance to handle institutional controls. And how can an insurer be then positive if these institutional controls are being executed?
That's a great question. I think it depends on what type of coverage you're looking at. In terms of the cost cap coverage, it is not unreasonable for the insurer to take some sort of a provision on there and put that responsibility on the group contractually responsible for carrying out that control. On the liability side of the house, I think that is clearly one of the risks that are insurable. That being said, you cannot insure the willful violation of the law. So if the institutional control is willfully being violated by the insured, it's kind of like going out and trying to buy, personal liability insurance for, committing murder. It's not gonna apply for you to, for that issue. So I hope that kind of answers it, but if the control mechanism has just failed, and there was no willfulness in the act, then I think that's clearly an insurable risk.
And I might add to that, Ellen, that it is a very important issue in a lot of these sites because of the performance standards that are used for cleanups. And the real additional problem is how do you bind future owners to the site who are not a privy to the current contracts? And I think a lot of thought has to be given to whether the current parties involved in negotiations want to file restrictive covenants against the properties that run with the land to put future buyers on notice. I think that's one way to put a buyer on notice that could be subject to a contractual obligation for which they're not privy to.
Great, thanks. We have another question, Art, about your example. The question comes from Arthur Odozuski from Michigan DEQ. He says, the American Brass insurance settlement sounds similar to the TRC AIG Tecumseh Heart Project in Wisconsin. Has AIG or other insurers ever paid on an environmental policy to claim, paid a claim for an environmental policy where costs have gone over what the consultant, like TRC, was willing to pay?
I don't have any personal experience on that.
And his next question has it been difficult to get insurers to settle claims? And we've covered that a little bit.
I can speak from just more empirical data. I mean, very few claims are litigated. Are there denials of claims? Absolutely. And more often than not, the denials are for good cause. I mean, it's clearly in the contract that it didn't provide the coverage. Where there's ambiguity, and that does arise, because so few claims are litigated, I'm talking about the court, there usually is some sort of settlement. And in those settlements that I've seen, neither side is happy. But it's rare. I mean, of all claims that should be paid, I bet you it's way less than 5%, if not less than 3% or 2% of the claims that ultimately have some dispute aspect to them. So it's a rarity, but it exists. It's just like any contract. I have not yet, and I can't speak to, I can speak to generally speaking, whether it's AIG or other insurers who have over time paid on cost overrun insurance. Absolutely they've paid. I know AIG has, but also the other insurers. And there's a reason why some of the insurers that I mentioned no longer offer cost overrun insurance is because they paid too much. And other insurers that weren't even on that list no longer are in the business of providing environmental insurance. They came in and out in the 90s. They thought it was a good place to come in, and now they're not in the market at all.
Ellen, can I just make a general observation on the questions here that are being presented? In my view, the environmental insurance vehicle is obviously important to protect against the unknown liability, but equally as important in my view on these deals is it gives you the parties the opportunity to quantify the business risk. You get a number that you can use in the deal to set the price rather than all the parties wringing their hands on the unknown risk. It is equally valuable, I think, for putting a number on the unknown risk that can be factored into the deal and the buy-sell agreement. And it saves a lot of time by quantifying the unknown. And that, in my view, is almost as important and maybe even more important than providing the liability protection that the insurance agreement affords.
And Ken, Art, I think that's the perfect way to end today's seminar. Thank you very much, everyone, for participating. Thank you very much to Ken Anderson for being our speakers. I do want to remind you all, before you hang up, don't go yet. Before you go away, make sure that you fill out our feedback form. Like I've mentioned, this is the first time we have ever done this in this kind of a venue. We very much appreciate
you right now.
Whether or not this was a valuable resource for you. Again, I'd like to thank everyone for participating, and we had just received a few more questions. Some of them were a bit detailed, and we will commit to getting responses to you. And if you think of more questions, please, again, feel free to email Art, Ken, or myself. Thank you again for participating, and take care.